I think it's now been approximately a year. So since we entered the universe of the pandemic, I think it's about a year. It's not that little warnings weren't around, but I think it's been about a year since kind of societally people began to get what was going on, both in our country and in the world. Yeah, so it's been a very interesting year. It already had been an interesting year. I mean, interesting, I don't mean in a good way. I mean, we already had been in a social and political situation where seeds of divisiveness, seeds of anger, seeds of hatred, seeds of intolerance, just the whole national discourse had become quite toxic. We had already been through a number of years where science and the facts of life were disputed, were denied, were made fun of. And we can say, and that was really before the pandemic, there was something else that really united all of us, the world, and that, of course, is climate change, which is another issue that affects everyone, every living thing in the world. But we know even that issue, which is so obvious to people who study it, and to many parts of the world where it's very kind of obvious that something's going on, we know that denial, indifference, attacking those that disagree with you, making fun of, demeaning, were already, present in our national discourse. So it shouldn't have surprised us when the pandemic came along that it entered this toxic world. That has been unfolding now for quite a long time. And as a mental health person, as a therapist, many of these psychological, denial, delusion, living in delusion, living in illusion, denying what's right in front of you, not wanting to face the facts of one's own situation or relation or other people or confusion, are very common. I mean, they were not known to me. I think we're just not, we're thrown off when we see the same very personal issues that unfold within human beings and in relationships in a very intimate way are also being played out on a national and international level. So in terms of the pandemic and the political situation, as a community, we have done our best to bring light, bring clarity, bring intelligence to our members and to the people who listen, the people who practice with us. We've wanted to be there to support people and nurture people during this difficult time and give them the tools to not only survive, but also to, in a certain way, prosper. And so this has been going on now, again, for nearly a year. And it's interesting, this sort of... It's interesting in the past month or two in talking to members, and I spend a lot of time talking to members. It's sort of like there's a weariness now that I get in people. I think in the beginning it was all quite new. The challenges were great, a lot of unknowing, a lot of instability, how this was going to play out. But a year later, we know how it's playing out, and we know how it's going to continue to play out, which means, in a certain sense, we don't know how it is, but we know it takes time. And I think I really want to talk today about I think the effects of people being alone. People, obviously, many people, obviously not everybody in our country, but have been quarantined or semi-quarantined. People are not going to the office. People are working at home. They're not interacting with colleagues. They're not interacting with friends. They're, you know, when they're out and about, they have to be very cautious, keep socially distant, wear masks. You know, it's almost like we see other people as potential dangers. It's very interesting. Sometimes I forget what's going on, and so I come probably a little closer than 6 feet to some people, sort of talk to them, and it's been interesting to me to really see people look scared, respond with fear. When that, it's not like I was, you know, breathing on them or anything, but even just, you know, so we've all developed these bubbles around us. And again, now for many, it's been a year. And I think, again, for lots of people, I mean, obviously people who live alone, it is more difficult. People who have, few social resources, it is more difficult. But even people who even have other people in their bubble are getting a little weary of the same bubble, after a year. So my sense is it's time to renew. Because I think in the beginning there were so many contradictory messages. There was a sense that this thing, you know, would all be over by the summer. I remember even medical people telling me, "Yeah, it'll all be over by the summer." Summer came, wasn't over, got worse. You know what I mean? And we've been through all these up and downs. And now, I mean, maybe just personally speaking, I mean, it's I've gotten my, I'm fortunate. There are, the usual people think of the disadvantages of aging, but in the pandemic, there is an advantage of aging, which is you get the vaccine first. So because I'm 75, I've had my first shot, I'm getting my second shot this week, which I really was very, felt good about, like freedom. And then I was told, "No, Fred, you're still going to have to wear your mask. You're still going to have to keep socially distant. I mean, you're still, you can now be a carrier." Well, we don't know. You may or may not be, but there's a chance. So therefore, and it was just funny. It was like, So again, we don't know how this is going to play out, do we? And I think it's very important as practitioners. We don't turn away from it, and we are very attentive to what's going on within us. And so I think that's what I'm going to talk about mostly today, but first I want to talk about loneliness. Aloneness. I think back in the 50s, maybe people older can remember, there was a sociologist who wrote a book called The Lonely Crowd. It was sort of a popular bestseller. And again, it just popped into my mind. I mean, that was way back then, where he really, probably made a case based on some research and observation that Americans, even though they could be in lots of crowds, families and on and work and crowds in the urban areas, they were noticing more and more that people were lonely. I think he made a case that sort of a kind of an existential loneliness was becoming very much part of the American mindset. And it often had nothing to do whether people were alone or not. I mean, that was his thesis, the lonely crowd. So I think the seeds of loneliness, of aloneness, of disconnection and separation are in us. And there are lots of cultural and sociological issues why this is more the case in modern society. I won't go into it today. I think many of you probably understand how we live so much of our lives without the very extensive social connections that people of past generations had. And therefore, there was kind of a sense of interrelationship that was more suffused among many extensions. Americans, many of them don't have that anymore, right? In our work, in our neighborhoods, in our relationships, there's just a lot of instability, and change. So the ability to feel rooted. I remember Thich Nhat Hanh, when he first came to the West, he was quite amazed at the lack of roots of people. And he was especially amazed with his own people, his own Vietnamese people, who he knew from Vietnam until he went into exile, and coming out of a culture where people felt very rooted in their villages, rooted in their community, rooted in their families and their extended families, rooted in their traditions. And he was very surprised to encounter overseas Vietnamese who had been here one generation or already one generation or were new, how quickly they were changing, psychologically how they were changing, and kind of these kinds of feelings that were not that well known in traditional Vietnamese culture were so prevalent. Yeah, so seeds of loneliness, seeds of aloneness. In Buddhist psychology, everything is caused by something. And those seeds are within our own mind, what we call our storehouse. So even though we can talk about an external situation like a pandemic and quarantine and social isolation and disconnect, and people not seeing each other and people not working together and people, we all wear a mask, It's often hard to know who you're talking to. I mean, it's how quickly we've gotten used to not seeing each other's faces. How easily we've gotten used to talking to everybody as an image on a screen. How quickly we've become used to not touching. So these things are happening, but the psychological, emotional response to these things are within us. Those are just facts. Those are just things that are happening. But the way we respond to them, the way we feel about them, the way we react to them, are because we have those seeds. So we have to understand that. It doesn't mean that environment, in Buddhism we talk about cause and conditions. It doesn't mean that conditions, external conditions, aren't also watering seeds, right? But they're already in us, you see. And we have to be careful. And very mindful of our seeds, because they can take us over. And again, in the last month or two, I've just found that, you know, many people are having just a harder time, especially since, you know, there doesn't seem necessarily to be a clear light at the end of the tunnel, right? Every time we think there's a light, then you hear about, well, there are new variants, or, you know, and who knows what's around the corner. So many things, not just in terms of disease, but also in terms of climate change, other kinds of social issues. Yeah, so how do we respond to this? How do we make sure that the environment, the conditions, as well as my own condition and reactivity, that I am not in this difficult situation, watering seeds of affliction, watering seeds of suffering within myself and with others. So I'm turning this morning just to something that many of you are familiar with. It's part of our path of practice. The mind trainings, the Lojong, as it's called in Tibetan, this wonderful compendium of Buddhist teachers, that teachings, 59 of them, that are all just one sentence. And again, I think many of you are familiar with them. So a couple of them I think are very relevant. The first, in the section called The Transformation of Adversity into the Path of Awakening. And it reads, when misfortune fills the world and its inhabitants, make adversity the path of awakening. Or we could say, when misfortune fills the world and its inhabitants, take adversity as the path of awakening. So even though we are a year into this adversive, difficult situation, I think we constantly need to renew our understanding of this. So it's not just episodic. It's not just brought out in a difficult, adversive pandemic situation, or political situation, or climatic situation, or economic situation, but it becomes what the teachers, Atisha, who brought these from India to Tibet, that these are the very personal way each of us shows up in the world and deals with life. And again, you know, Atisha, you know, this, we're talking, you know, in the first millennium in India, these teachings, they're old. But adversity and aversive conditions in life are not old. War is not old. Violence is not old. Famine is not old. Drought is not old. You know, I mean, all, and so we are developing our own, you know, disease is not, no, as we know, is not unknown. Pandemics aren't unknown. These are part of the human experience. And if we don't clearly see, if we stop, you know, the reason there is this reminder is because we don't want it to be this way. We think adversity shouldn't be happening. We think adversity, difficult situations, challenges are getting in the way of my ability to be happy, my ability to lead a good life, my ability to cultivate all the qualities, you know, that I want to cultivate, including the qualities of how we relate to each other, love, compassion, understanding, patience, connection. I mean, so this verse tells us adversity, misfortune, difficulty is the path of practice. Let's just stop a minute. Close your eyes. And reflect for a moment. Is this really true? Or do I see life, do I really unconsciously, no matter what I may say, unconsciously every day expect my life to unfold the way I'd like it to unfold? And when situations occur that are aversive meaning, you know, they're not wanted, they're seen as negative, shouldn't be happening, that when adversity happens just in our own personal life, we are thrown by it because we don't expect it to be happening. We expect things to go our way. We expect people to do what we'd like them to do. We expect the world to be the way we think people ought to be. Isn't that true, really, the way we are? And when it's not that way, we are thrown. We are hurt. We are angered. We get scared. We get depressed. At worst, we give up. Oh, what's the use? No matter what efforts I make, look where I end up. Right? Please check your mind a moment. Before we talk about adversity as the path of practice, ask yourself, do I really no longer divide up the events of my life into wanted, unwanted, good, bad? Or do I? And which side do I really lean on? Which side do I really expect? This is very important, because if we aren't willing to accept that aversive, what we perceive as negative, challenging, people, situations don't belong in my life or in life, then we're always going to be in reactivity whenever it occurs. So please reflect again. Can I really stop dividing the world up in that way and just see all situations as just the unfolding of life according to causes and conditions? That's all that's going on. And wanted, unwanted, pleasurable, aversive, are just categories that I am making up. I am fabricating. That I am imposing, projecting onto the experiences of life, my own personal life, the life of the world. Because I cannot accept that everything, fundamental Buddhist teachings, everything, you know, dependent arising. Everything is arising because of something else. Everything is arising because of causes and conditions. This causes that. That causes this. That's all that's going on. So please ask yourself. I mean, you know, it's not like this is going to be a moment of great revelation and resolution, but it's a beginning to be honest with ourselves. Because if we haven't accepted this very basic teaching of Dharma, cause and effect, impermanence. I mean, this is where the Buddha began, before he even began to give quote-unquote higher teachings. He tried to show us what the reality of life is that he had learned. And I ask all of us, have we reflected enough on these truths, to really accept that they are true. For me, for you, for everyone, no matter whatever, how we try to cut people up and discriminate from this one, from that one, this country from that one, this race from that race, this is the truth of life. Can I accept this? Can I live in the world the way it is? And understand it. Understand what's going on. I mean, this means we're operating with some kind of wisdom, some kind of intelligence, which we all have. This is not extraordinary. We all have that. But if we don't live life in an intelligent, wise way, understanding what's going on, we will cause suffering for ourselves and others. So, first step is, can I totally accept everything in life? Okay? So, there's aversive and non-aversive. There's no teaching about, you know, take non-aversive situations, you know, as the path of practice, because we have no problem with non-aversive situations. We're quite willing to incorporate that in our life, see it as part of our life, be with it, work with it, relate to it. Right? Our problem is we cling to them, but that's another Dharma talk. Okay? So what this means, friends, is when we encounter quote-unquote adversity, which is again something that we put on life, it's something that we consider an aversive situation, when we encounter it, what do? Do we pull back? Do we react emotionally? With afflictive emotions? Do we hide? Do we get depressed? Do we get scared? These are all ways that we pull back into ourself. And we see this situation in a way that we, you know, that brings up, because we don't want it to be happening. We stand away from it and look at it, and it scares us, or it depresses us, or makes us angry. You see, those are all ways that we don't embrace the reality of life. But what this is getting at, take adversity, make adversity the path of awakening, is we, you know, and then let me see, there's another one further down which says, work with whatever you encounter immediately. So maybe that's the second part. That's the instruction. Well, what do I do? Just work with it, whatever it is. Now, what does that mean? because this first says, make adversity the path of awakening. So this text is written for people who are on a path of awakening, whatever that means to you. It could be the path of full awakening. I want to be enlightened. I want to be a Buddha. I really want to be of great benefit to beings. I want to be free of all suffering. Or it could be, you know, I'd like to be a little more awake. I find I'm often asleep at the wheel in my life. Right? I want to be more present to life. I want to be able to respond to life in a more awakened way, again, a more intelligent way, a more perceptive way, a more discerning way. I want to be awake, right? And so our path of awakening, whatever it is not something that occurs on the cushion. Our path of awakening is not something that occurs in our study. The path of awakening occurs in life. And life is what is unfolding moment to moment, experience to experience. So the path of awakening, which can sound very abstract, like, oh yes, I'm following the path of awakening. No. I'm following the path of my life, and I'm awakening, and I'm using my life and everything that occurs in my life to awaken. This is very important. This is what I think is being shared. It's a very profound part of practice. Many people see their path of awakening as a series of practices. I'm doing this practice, I'm doing this practice, I'm doing that practice, all this to awaken my mind. I'm studying this, I'm studying that, Well, that's wonderful. We're guilty here in our community. We offer retreats, intensives, workshops, classes, right? What are they for? They're to help us wake up. But the waking up has to happen in our life. That's where we wake up. Our path of practice, our path of awakening, is the path of our life. It doesn't occur anywhere else. And because our life is so conditioned by our minds, our thoughts, feelings, and all the projections, and our speech, since mind is the king, that the path of awakening has to be the path of awakening our minds. Because it is our minds in which all these situations, both personal within me, interpersonally, the whole world, whatever I'm thinking, whatever I'm feeling, however I'm interpreting, that's all going on in my mind. So awakening is something that occurs fundamentally in my mind. That's why meditation is so key to the Buddhist path, because meditation deals with the mind to help us transform the mind. So, when one is operating in the world like that, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of impose quarantines and social distancing and wearing masks and can't go here and can't go there. All right, our social freedom is being curtailed. But the path of awakening is not the path of social freedom, of being able to make endless choices and go where I want to go. I mean, this is why so many people are so upset at this, right? This is why so many people, the idea of changing their lifestyle to avert a catastrophe globally because of, is like, don't interfere with my personal life. Nobody tells me, right? Nobody tells me who I can be with, or whether I got to wear a mask or not, or how close I got to get to people. This is the world of self. This is not the awakened world that sees clearly our interconnection and our responsibility for each other. Right? So, the path of awakening is the path of the mind, and the path of the mind is in this situation, such as the pandemic. And now we learn, you respond immediately with whatever arises. So let's say you're noticing that you're getting a little weary. You're feeling disconnected. You're feeling separate, right? These things are just, you're just noticing these feelings. It's getting old, right? It's getting old. Or other kinds of things begin, you know. So immediately when they arise, what the trainee is saying, immediately right then, do something. Many of us don't do something until it gets bad, you see. We go down, oh, I how much more of this can I take? Or, you know, you just, or you think, oh, you know, or we get into poor me, right? You know, I'm alone, I'm so lonely. You know, other people are out there, not me. How come no one's calling me? You know what I mean? You see, we're doing this to ourselves. That whole dialogue is going on within our own mind. And what are we nurturing? Remember I talked about positive and negative seeds, wholesome, unwholesome seeds. We are nurturing unwholesome seeds in us, which I remember we started out with an unwanted situation, an aversive situation. And what have we done? We've turned that aversive situation into a contributor or a trigger to enhance the cultivation of our afflictive seeds, which only makes it worse. And I just use that as one example. So we have to use what we're learning, which is to be mindful. Mindfulness means I'm aware of what's going on. I'm aware of what's going on within me and without me, and I can name it, you see. It's not just like, oh, you know, everything's everything. I'm just mindful. I'm mindful, I'm, you know, going over the cliff, right? No. When you first see you're going over the cliff, do something, you know? But many of us go over the cliff in our own minds. We get on the rabbit hole in our own minds. And it's, you know, so. Adversity, aversive situations. How do we What is the antidote? What is the path of practice? What is the path of awakening? What can we do when we notice? Well, again, one of the first things, you know, that's why I wanted to have this talk with this morning is, I think we have to renew, because, you know, I think we have to renew our commitment to practice. To freshen up, to refreshen, right? Because as soon as I say, oh, this has been going on a year, I can't take any more of this, or this will never end, you know, it's never going to stop, it's never going to change, we are doing what? We are living in the past, we are living in the future, we're artificially connecting them, and we're burdening ourselves with something that is not true. It's just something we develop in our mind. There is no past and future. All there is what? There's only this moment. That's the truth. You know? I mean, I might have been in quarantine for the past year. Right? But that's just a thought. That's just a memory. The truth is, in this moment, I am right here. In this moment, of awakening, of waking up in the morning, this is a brand new day. And this, you know, in Zen, in Dzogchen, this is where we want to learn how to live. So when that mind starts roaming into the past, creating lots of, you know, kind of a miserable story about the past, creates a miserable story about the future, links them up with a miserable present, we have to be very careful, because we're just tying ourselves up So we have to awaken in that moment. Wake up to what? Awakening means wake up. We got to wake up in that moment and go, the truth is, there's only now. That's the truth. There's only now. And in this moment of now, I have a choice. How do I want to be right now? See, that's empowering. The other is, you know, what's the opposite? Victimization, right? And we have to be very careful that we don't see ourselves. I mean, the whole thing about the Buddhism is it teaches us that we can be empowered in life. Because we have freedom of mind. We can't always be empowered to control our external situations, but we are empowered that we can control our mind, we can control the actions of our speech, we can control the actions of our body. And that's empowering. We have to remind ourselves, you know, right now I have the power, right in this moment, to be here and to show up in this moment. Well, how do you want to show up in this morning? What's your practice? Oh, what's my practice? Well, one of the things, you know, we've learned from Thich Nhat Hanh is nourish yourself. Touch life in a very direct way, in a way that is not mediated by thought, especially when our thoughts are very skewed in a negative way. We wake up. I'm alive. That's interesting. I'm alive. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, present. I'm alive. Can I touch this moment? Can I connect? I might not be able to connect with all my friends the way I'd like, but can I connect with myself in this moment and connect with the environment around me? Connect. Be present too. Touch. I remember the first time I heard Thay talk about the senses, and rather than, you know, contact, he said touch. He said, you know, imagine when you see something, your eyes are touching the object, your ears are touching the sound, right? Touching. Sometimes we can't touch other people. Again, we are social beings. We grow up in the womb of our mothers, where we're in contact. When we come out, somebody holds us. We're in contact. Hopefully there's been people over the course of our years who've touched us and we've touched them. We do have that social dimension, but we can't be dependent on it. This is what many of us are learning. I'm too dependent. Right? I'm too dependent on others. I need to learn, and I think that's one thing the pandemic has shown us, how quickly things can change, how quickly we can be alone, be isolated, how quickly life can change. You know, I mean, I think part of the problem for so many people, they can't change. All they can do is keep doing the same thing, you know, go out to the sports bar, let's have a good time, right? I mean, you see what I'm saying? I don't, be with their friends, be with their families, connect, have a good time, you know. They can't change. It's too scary. We are afraid of being alone. We don't know how to be alone. We don't know how to be with ourselves. You know, I often say, you know, there's so much stimulation in this culture. You know, that even when we're not with people, we can be connecting through media 24/7. So we never give ourselves time to really go, how am I inside, you see? To find out how we are inside, we have to turn off the music. We have to be willing to step back and ask ourselves, do I know how to be comfortable in my own skin? Do I know how to be comfortable within my own mind? You know, it's almost like a question, yeah, so if this doesn't change, you know, and we just stumble along from one pandemic to another, and you know, could it happen? Could happen, you know. Can I be okay? Do I know how to take care of my mind? Do I know how to cultivate connection? I mean, there's, you know, blue sky, flowers, taste of food, just looking at things with appreciation, connecting. Do I know how to connect with life, even alone? You know, many people, they don't feel real unless they're telling somebody their story. Many people, as soon as something happens in their life, they have to tell somebody. And many times they tell the same story over and over again to anybody who listens. It's almost like if I'm the only one who knows the story of my life, it has no meaning. No. Again, it doesn't mean that we don't talk to people and tell them what's going on in their life, but it's not as if I need to. There's no freedom in that. And it's kind of a sad commentary on us if I don't feel my life is real, my experiences are real, unless I get validity in somebody from somebody else. Can you feel how unempowered that is? So, you know, we take adversity. Like, let's say you just said, well, I mean, Fred just said that, and somebody goes, well, that sounds like me. Wow, I wonder, you know, okay, that's fine. Let's just stop and look at that. Let's reflect on that. And think, where is this really coming from? Now you're asking yourself, why do I do this? Why do I have this need? And is there another way? Is there another way that I can live? Is there another way that I can be? That somehow my own moment-to-moment connection with life is enough for me to be happy, to me to have meaning. And then our entrance into the life of the world, the life of others, so-called, just becomes an add-on, you see. But we want the ground to be solid, so we're not endlessly grasping, not endlessly seeking, not endlessly needing, not endlessly wanting. You know, we've all read the books, haven't we? I mean, what was the bestseller, you know? Well, Eckhart Tolle, right? I mean, I don't know how many millions of his books he sells, right? I mean, everybody loves to read about the now. But how many people really are willing to live in the now? Right? We love Thich Nhat Hanh. Everybody loves Thich Nhat Hanh. I've never met anybody who doesn't love Thich Nhat Hanh. Right? I mean, right? I mean, he's universally loved. People in all different kind of traditions will quote Thich Nhat Hanh, right? I mean, what does he teach? I mean, he teaches many things, but like, yeah. Happiness is available right now. I mean, happiness is available right now. If I think I need to do this, this, and this, and this to be happy, to be fulfilled, to find meaning, I've come away from my essential wholeness. So we might say, what is the path of awakening? The path of awakening is waking up to my essential wholeness. My essential capacity right now to be happy just being here, wherever here is, doing what it's ever doing, even in the midst of so-called adversity. Because I know how to show up. I know how to be present. I know how to be intelligent. I know how to be compassionate. I know how to always, okay, big time pandemic, lots of people suffering. How can I be of help? Simple. Right? Same aspiration as yesterday. How can I be of help? Who can I support? Who can I reach out to? Same. Yeah, so let me stop, because I'd like to hear. So any questions? And please chat them in. You know, there are a lot of us on, and it gets a little chaotic with 100-plus people, too. So just chat them in. Maggie's there. Everybody who aren't, anybody not Zoom sophisticated, on the bottom of your screen, you'll see an icon chat. If you click on that, a screen will come up and you can write your question on it. And then, you know, let's be very open and honest with each other. Do you have any question? One is understanding what's being presented, and two, understanding how to practice it in a very real way. You know, how would you practice in your own life? Okay. And please be aware that if you do chat in, you know, nobody else in the virtual meditation hall or in the real meditation hall. You know, it's all private. I mean, Maggie will just relay it to me without a name. Sometimes, you know, we're a little private about exposing ourselves.
Thank you, Fred. Emotions such as deep grief at the loss of a loved one, is that something to just accept when the crying doesn't stop while smiling at the flowers?
You know, so. When we lose somebody, which means I imagine somebody has died, which is a normal condition of life, just the when and the how is unknown, but you know, death comes to everybody. And when it happens, based on our connection with that person, based on the role they played in our life, and you know, lots of things, it is normal to feel grief. I mean, grief is sadness, isn't it? It's a name we give to the sadness of loss. Yeah, so that's normal. And again, because we're present to what's going on. I mean, presence is not denial, or it's not repression. It's not like, oh no, I don't want to feel this, so I'm going to go look at the flowers. That's, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying when you're in grief, you're in grief. But if you're just present to your grief and you're not nurturing it, you're not nursing it. You're willing to just let it unfold in its natural way. And grief has its own natural way of unfolding. It unfolds like every other situation in life. It is impermanent, like happiness. It is impermanent. So, you know, usually based on how strong our connection was with that person, et cetera, you know, the degree of our grief, our grieving, you know, will be different from situation to situation. But if we just with it and we just present to it and we hold it and we understand it and we accept it, it will gradually over time decrease. Now, at the same time, sometimes grief, many people can get caught into it. So it doesn't run its natural cycle. It begins to loop around. And then it's no longer a natural grief, but a sort of a grief that is being held onto. Sometimes people, and you know, one of the things about grief, because it is, you know, it in the short term, grief feels like depression. And so one of the things about depression is one naturally loses one's interest in life. One naturally loses anhedonia. One doesn't take pleasure in life. That's kind of a natural thing. But some people then hold on to their grief, but they feel guilty. You know, they would feel guilty if they're nurturing themselves by, you know, looking at a flower, looking at the sky, thinking positive, wholesome thoughts, listening to music. Well, I have an antidote for that, because, you know, this week is actually the anniversary of my mother. She died a year ago, and, you know, she was 102, so I'd really known her my whole life, a very significant person in my life. For a long time afterwards, when I would look at flowers, because I know she loved flowers, I would look at it because I'm looking with her eyes. I would listen to the music she loved, and I was listening with her ears. She wasn't here to enjoy the things in life that she enjoyed, but I could enjoy them for her, and I was aware of that. So I was being nurtured, and she was being nurtured. So that's one little thing that I learned. Yes, Maggie, are there other questions?
Another thank you. The need to immediately empower myself to respond to adversity right away, right now, not later, means that I have to be present to moment in order to turn adversity onto the path. Is this correct?
Couldn't have been said better. But we may not all be that good. Right. So that certainly, you know, is a very wonderful way. But, you know, sometimes it takes a few minutes or a few hours or a few days, because many of us are not that immediately present to ourselves and are not that consciously living with this sense of every moment is an opportunity for awakening and just able to deal with everything, you know, in that moment-to-moment way. But, you know, I think if we are mindful of our feelings, mindful of our state, we will see things, we will feel things. And, you know, so I would say, you know, the more mindful we are, the more present we are, the more we have criteria between wholesome and unwholesome, the more we can see our reactivity or our walling off or our falling back or our self-pitying or, you know, and put a name on it, and remind ourselves that we've chosen another path in life, you know, I think that should be our goal, to get better at. You know, and we can all do that. Now, obviously, you know, daily meditation is a wonderful thing. You know why? If it's real, because in daily meditation, we stop. And we pull back from our life, and we pull back within ourselves. And if we pull back within ourselves, if there are feelings or things going on in us that we have not been aware of as we go about our daily round, we should be able, we will feel them if they're real. And if we're willing to be present to them and understand what's causing them and understand there is another way, there is a healthy way of dealing with afflictive feelings, but there is another way to chart with us that we cultivate wholesomeness, positive feelings. So again, I think we have to be honest with ourselves where we're at and just have a real model of just, you know, how can I do better and better? But we can't baby ourselves. And many of us, especially with afflictive mind states, we have a pattern of self-indulgence, even though it causes us misery. We just self-indulge this. And you know, some of these minds, these self-pitying mind states or cultivating, you know, mind states that make us feel depressed or angry or sad, these unwholesome mind states, these unwholesome seeds, we have to be very careful not to be cultivating them. They'll arise on their own. We don't need to work on it. But when they arise, and if we can be aware and mindful and present of what's going on, then we have the opportunity of doing something different. Yes, Maggie.
This next one is more of a comment.
Uh-huh.
Dear Fred, as you spoke, I realized that my go-to is an expectation for others to perform, as in take care of things. This is a distraction or obstacle of what they should have done to just immediately taking care of what is before me, owning my own activity and actually working with and touching it. I see this clearly. Thank you.
Yeah, so, it's funny, my friends, we all know this stuff, you know, when we stop, you know, because I would imagine mostly all of us on this call, you know, we have some degree of self-awareness. We're intelligent. We have ability to perceive things with some degree of directness. We know we've been exposed to the Dharma. It's that what the woman just said or the man just said. It's when we stop and we're just present to what's going on, and we name it. And we remember there is another way. And all of that other way is suffused in this one little sentence, the path of awakening. You know, the path of awakening means in this moment, no matter what I got myself into, I can wake up. I can see where I am, I can remember where I want to be, and I can get back on that road. That's practice. I mean, that's what practice is. Practice is waking up, you know, finding yourself in your habitual response, waking up, being aware, seeing what's going on, labeling it, and remembering there is another way. And just getting back on. Getting back on the bicycle, as they say, or getting back on the horse, whatever it is. The horse of practice, yes. Good. So then let me just, before we end, thank you everybody. Since we've been talking about the path of practice, I happen to notice that one of our intensives, the wisdom intensive, has closed, and I think the other two, the mindful living path and the Dharma path intensives, close this coming week. Especially for those of you who are newer to our community, you know, intensives are really sort of the glue. They're a way that we, they're the river of practice. They're a way we practice together. We learn, you know, we learn from who's ever, you know, teaching in the intensive. You know, we learn from each other. There's a lot of support. You know, it's funny. Over the years, we would, you know, we have a membership, I think it's a little over 300. But every year, I would say 10% of the people, their membership lapses. I mean, that's fine. I mean, a lot of people are, I mean, I don't, you know, anybody can join with a click, so it doesn't, people could be joining for all kinds of reasons. But it's very interesting. When you look at that 30 or 40 people whose membership lapse, they are primarily people who've never gotten involved. I mean, that is the variable that stands out the most. You know, intensives, no. Retreats, no. You know what I mean? Just maybe a little here, a little there. And that tells me something. And not that these people didn't come into the community with good aspiration, but they didn't step into the river of practice. And then eventually they'll step out. Hopefully they'll step in somewhere else. So I just want to remind you that that's ending this week. Another thing I want to say, the Dharma talk next week will be given by somebody most of you don't know, Marcy Meckling. Marcy is a student of mine and a member of the community for many years from North Carolina. I have great respect for Marcy because all the things that we have down here, she doesn't have. She doesn't have a local sangha at all. She practices on her own, as well as she has what's called the full catastrophe of life, in a good sense. She is married. She has two teenage daughters. She and her husband own a very active business. So, you know, she is somebody fully involved in life. And yet, I would say she's a very wonderful practitioner. So she's coming down here for a week of solitary retreat, and I asked her whether she would give the Dharma talk next week. So I invite you to come here, Marcy, next Sunday, and I'll be here to introduce her.